The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Cynthia Schemmer, and I'm honored to introduce our guest this evening. Since 1991, Rachel Louise Snyder has traveled to more than 50 countries. She's interviewed the Dalai Lama, spent a month driving across Cuba, covered natural disasters in Honduras and Indonesia, and relocated from Chicago to Cambodia to become a contributor for the public radio shows, Marketplace, and All Things Considered. Her first book, Fugitive Denim, was featured on This American Life and received a 2006 Lowell Thomas Award from the Overseas Press Club. Her second novel, What We've Lost Is Nothing, was named an Outstanding New Voice in Fiction by the Library Journal. In her most recent book, No Visible Bruises, Snyder investigates the true scale of domestic violence in our country, and the book is described by Eve Ensler as a seminal and breathtaking account of why home is the most dangerous place to be a woman. Through brilliant insights and myth-busting research, compelling storytelling, and a passionate focus on truth-telling, Rachel Louise Snyder places domestic violence exactly where it should be, smack in the center of everything. No Visible Bruises received the Lucas Work in Progress Award from the Columbia School of Journalism and Harvard's Nyman Foundation. Currently, Snyder is an associate professor of creative writing and journalism at American University in Washington, D.C. And now, please give a warm welcome to Rachel Louise Snyder.
Hello. I don't have my phone up here because I'm going to be distracted. I have my phone up here because about a week and a half ago, I began to start every event by reading a text or an email or some missive that I got from somebody who is in the world today struggling with domestic violence or the result of domestic violence in her life. So far, it's been almost all women. And I feel compelled to do this because this feels like a very real, very palpable problem. Many of us, especially when people come to my readings, they're coming kind of post-event, right? They're coming because they've come out of some terrible situation and they are survivors now. And for me, it's really important to remember that we're not all post, that there are many people sort of suffering this today. And I'm getting emails and tweets and all kinds of social media posts, and I can't, you know, I'm hoping to figure out how to reply to people still. I haven't figured that out, but so this is the one I'm gonna start with today. I don't give people's names or identifying information. Hello there, I read your book, and it was the first time I've really felt validated as a woman who lived this experience. I have so much more I could say about it, but today I'm writing to you about my son. He is 9 years old, and he wants to kill himself. His abusive father retains decision-making rights and has prevented our son from receiving appropriate mental health treatment for years now. I am running out of time. I am out of money. I don't know how to fight this in a system that doesn't value children's rights, my rights, or mental health. Please, please write our story. So, I have a couple of passages I'm going to read from tonight, just a few little paragraphs here and there, but really I like to talk. I'm kind of a talker. You'd notice, if you knew my dad, you'd know where I got it from. And I want to tell you a story of my life 2 weeks ago. I've been on book tour. My book came out May 7th. I left on book tour May 8th. And I've been basically on the road ever since then. And what's today? Wednesday. So it'll be 3 weeks ago this Friday. I got off a plane. I flew from Cleveland to my home in D.C. And I got off a plane and had a whole series of frantic text messages and voicemails from one of my dearest friends, who have known someone I've known for more than 20 years, a friend of mine in Chicago, where I'm from. She said, "Something is happening at Jason's house." Jason is her brother. And part of the reason she called me was that Jason and his wife Lola were going through a really terrible divorce, but also Jason and Lola's children went to school with my daughter, and I had this friend for 20 years, and so I had a whole series of overlaps with this family. And I called my ex-husband, who lives two blocks away. I said, get over to Jason and Lola's house. Get over there. There's something happening. And he called me back. He lives two blocks away. He called me back. He said, the SWAT team is here. And I was like, wait a minute, what? Now, this is a wealthy neighborhood in D.C. full of Foreign Service employees and lawyers. I mean, D.C. is all full of lawyers, so that's no surprise. But this is one of the wealthier suburbs. And I got on the phone with the SWAT team officer. I said, these are the kids' names. They're up the street at school right now. This is our daughters, their older daughter and my daughter, fifth graders, were both supposed to graduate that day from fifth grade. And while I was on the phone with them, it changed from a hostage situation to a crime scene, which means that the people in the home were no longer alive. So 3 weeks ago, in my inner circles, a man named Jason Reif killed his wife and then killed himself. His daughter, older daughter, is one of my daughter's best friends. His sister is now living at my house. His mother is at my house right now watching my dog in D.C. And this is a situation that, I mean, the savage irony of having a domestic violence homicide book tour interrupted by a domestic violence homicide is beyond anything that I, as a writer, could conjure. And we're living this real time, just sort of day by day. And of course, in my mind, I'm thinking, what could I have done? Like, I'm supposed to be the expert. I've been working on this for almost a decade. What could I have done? And I, you know, I knew both Jason and Lola, and I frankly did not have a lot of love for either one of them. Their divorce was so toxic, I thought neither one of them was putting their children first. But I did ask his sister a couple of questions about him because I knew that he had isolated himself. I said, does he have access to a gun? She said, no, I don't think so. And I said, is there any physical abuse that you know of in the house? No, I don't think so. Has he ever strangled Lola or has she ever strangled him? No, not that I know of. So I went through some of the questions of the danger assessment that you'll know if you read my book. And you know, the thing is, I don't know that I'm ever going to have answers. I am, for lack of a better term, on the perpetrator's side. So people who were friends with Lola, who were related to Lola, are not actually talking to me, which I completely understand. At the same time, Jason's sister has really urged me not to stop talking about it, not to be quiet about it, not to relegate this to a private matter, because this is something, this is rippling through the entire city of D.C. Jason and Lola were both State Department employees. They were, you know, middle class, upper middle class people. The idea that this only happens to an other or a certain person is wrong. And my hope for this discussion of domestic violence, which is a terrible term, but my hope is that we begin to have discussions about this. I mean, there's a lot of women who come to my readings, and I love that, right? Like, we're a tribe. I love all these women here. But I gotta say that domestic violence is a men's problem, right? We do not beat ourselves up. We do not rape ourselves. We do not strangle ourselves. And we need men to be there for us, to speak to other men. We need men to be our allies for us. And when the Brett Kavanaugh hearings happened, which to me were a seminal moment in my lifetime, I think that I am not wrong in saying that millions of conversations were happening between women and their dads and their husbands and their brothers and their male friends saying, yeah, you know what happened to me when I was 14? You know what happened to me when I was 17? It happened to me with my dad. My dad texted me the day of the hearings. I was glued to my computer watching the hearings. I said, oh, Dad, remember this story from when I was 13 with my sister's boyfriend? You know, and I think that those conversations really spurred the Me Too movement, and that's what I want to see happen with domestic violence. I want us to normalize the discussion on domestic violence, and that, more than anything, I think gives power to a social movement. And I think that whatever legislation we do, you know, legislation always follows social movements. You look at the union movement, you look at civil rights, you look at, you know, well, we still have to pass the ERA, for crying out loud. But you look at the women's movement, any of those powerful movements, the legislation followed the social movements. So the social movements need to start in our homes, with our families, with our loved ones. I'm going to read just a couple of little sections of my book and talk in between. So the book is divided into three parts. The first part is called The End, and it's about the story of a woman who was killed by her husband, and then he killed his two kids, and then he killed himself in Billings, Montana, and it changed everything in that state about how they grapple with domestic violence from every angle. The second part of the book is called The Beginning, and it follows a couple of abusers who are trying to learn to be nonviolent men, which is, I think, a point of view that we don't get nearly enough. And then the third part is called The Middle. This made editing really confusing, because I would say to my editor, do you mean the end, or do you mean the beginning, the end, you know? And we still, like, have not clarified how to talk about it. But anyway, the last part is called The Middle, and it's really about change makers. This book is not just all darkness. It really does end, I believe, on a note of hope and on what we can do and what people out there are doing. So the woman who was killed in Montana was named Michelle Monson. She was very young. She was 23. And this scene opens with me talking to her father. Both her father and her husband was named Rocky, his father. I was the first person that either one of them ever spoke to about the murders. And they were incredibly powerful, powerful moments for me as a writer, but also just as a human who is empathetic in the world. So this is the very beginning of the book. I drive my rental car from downtown Billings to a four-story house far outside of town, perched up on a hill, where the man inside can view anything that might come at him. Telescopic observation of the world outside. Mountains, plains, escape routes to everywhere in Montana and beyond. The man I'm here to see has avoided me for a long time. Passive avoidance. I've come to Billings from my home in Washington, D.C. Talked to his daughters, his ex-wife, caseworkers. Returned again. I know the town now. Some of the police, some of the prosecutors, advocates, hotel workers, and even the printer whose wife runs a basement museum dedicated to women. And now finally, on this, maybe my third visit, he's agreed to see me. I talk to a lot of people who don't want to talk to me. People who've murdered their families. People who've nearly been murdered. People who've arrested those murderers. People who've grown up with people who nearly murdered them. Men like Paul Monson are always reluctant to talk. Reluctant to voice the magnitude of what they've lost. Because what they've lost skirts the very limit of their imaginations. In November of 2001, Paul Monson's son-in-law, Rocky Mosier, bought a gun from the Thrifty Nickel, the classified paper where you can buy everything from a ferret to a tractor to a piano. Then he went home where his wife and Paul's daughter, Michelle, had just fed the kids dinner. A neighbor saw Rocky peering in the windows. Sometime after, one by one, he shot them. Michelle, his daughter, Christy, his son, Kyle, then himself. It was a case that shocked the entire state. Michelle was young, 23, her kids 6 and 7, in first and second grade, learning to read, drawing stick people and lollipop trees. Paul found Kyle slumped on the stairs, Rocky at the bottom, his face all twisted, scribblings on his arms in what looked like magic marker. Michelle's car was there, and for a few minutes, Paul thought maybe she was alive. He ran to the backyard, then the garage. He saw Rocky's Mustangs, a bag of family videos. Then the police came, and they found Michelle. So one of the interesting things about this case and this story was that Rocky had these videos. He had taken videos of their whole lives, the two kids and his wife and him. And there were about 14 hours of videos, and Michelle's father, Paul, made copies of all those videos for me. And as a writer, that is a sort of a level of access and trust that is profound. And I really wanted to honor that. And it was hard for me to watch those videos. But I also got a real sense of their personalities. I watched them as a couple. I watched them interact. And Paul said to me when he gave them to me, he said, you know, maybe you'll see something I didn't. And it was kind of a long time before I watched them, like a couple of years I had to bring myself to watch them. And you can see the kids aging as the videos go on, so you get a sense of where you are in time. And one of the more striking elements of those videos was that Michelle was only 14 when she met Rocky, and he was 10 years older, not an uncommon scenario in domestic violence situations, neither the age difference or the youth of the victim. And you could see Rocky. He would like come in the bedroom and he would throw back the sheets, and she'd be there like in a t-shirt and underwear, and she was gorgeous. She had this like perfect, you know, 17-year-old body. And she would, in the beginning, she would say things like, you know, cut it out, stop it. And he would sort of tease her and be like, look at those legs, look at that ass. And she'd be like, stop it. And of course, he never did, right? He never stopped it. And as the kids got to be a little bit older, so they're 6 and 7 when they died, so when they're 2 and 3 or 3 and 4, he would do the same thing. He would film her legs, or he would film her rear, and he would make comments on it. But her reaction to him became more and more muted, right? So she'd be like, cut it out, you know, just stop it, and, you know. And then in the very last set of videos in the summer before they were killed, they're killed at Thanksgiving in 2001, so this would have been like August 2001, they're in a cave, and they're with the kids, and they're walking up, they're like climbing up something, it's kind of dark, you can't see, but Rocky again has the video camera, and he trains it on her ass, and he says, look, kids, there's your mom's ass, and he makes some sort of sexist remark about it. And by now, she doesn't even say a word about it, not even acknowledge that he says it. And I thought, there, right there, there is the power and control of that situation. There is how the loss of agency happens and corrodes and erodes slowly over the years. She jokes, then she stops joking and asks him to stop. He doesn't stop, and she finally stops asking him. And this is how power and control work in this kind of relationship. So while I never saw him haul off and hit her necessarily on the videos, I saw that loss of power and that loss of agency on her behalf. So I just want to read one other short section on Rocky and Michelle. Rocky was a wiry guy, 5'5" and high strung, jittery, energetic. His family describes him as quiet, somewhat devious. Before he shot himself, he took the years of family videos, packed them in a bag, and put them in the garage. He wanted to be sure they'd be saved. Homage to a happy American family. If it had all gone as planned, that might have been the story that survived, a great American tragedy. On his arms, he'd written, I deserve to go to hell. There are dents in Paul Monson's front door, and he tells me that they're from a time Rocky tried to beat him down to get to Michelle. But at the time, that didn't really register to Paul as violent, not dangerously so. It's the kind of violence that seems so difficult to evaluate in the moment, but crystal clear in hindsight, which is to say that this is precisely what domestic violence looks like. Paul is hardly alone in his failure to register the portent of it. But imagine it's not Rocky at Paul's front door, beating at it, kicking it, screaming for a woman inside. Imagine it's a stranger. Who wouldn't call the police? Who wouldn't try to intervene to stop the violence? And yet, when it comes to people we know, people we see in other contexts, as fathers, brothers, sons, cousins, mothers, daughters, whatever, we have trouble registering the violence. Now Paul says he'd intervene. He'd do something, take the law into his own hands somehow. It's a Montana thing, the libertarian, individualistic culture of the place. He doesn't trust the system, doesn't think the police really did much to save his daughter or the prosecutor. One thing I want to tell you that'll give you insight into Montana, Paul says. When he asked for the autopsies of the family, the coroner said he could only release those related to Paul by blood, Michelle, Christy, Kyle, but not Rocky. But when Rocky's father, Gordon Mosier, asked, he got all four of them. The point is the view that the man owns it, Paul told me. The patriarchy sets the rules. The more you think about it, Paul says, the more it'll piss you off. He pulls out a brown accordion file and shows me the three autopsy reports he managed to get. Kyle's report begins, "This young boy is received with blood saturating the clothes." The coroner noted that the decedent had recently eaten gummy candy. Christy's report said her gunshot wound followed a pattern of metallic snow. Her heart weighed 180 grams. I think we often get the point of view of the victim if we get any point of view, and it was really important to me to try to have an understanding of what it felt like to be on the other side of that as much as I could, as much as somebody would let me in. And I found really interesting offender intervention groups all over the country. I sat in on many, many of them. And, you know, they're fascinating from a number of different angles. I mean, I have four brothers. Two of them are here tonight. Hi, guys. Look at, they wave in unison. That's how Snyders wave. So I think I know a couple of things about guys. I mean, I grew up with four of them. They're all very different. Some of them I like better than others, you know. These two are okay. Well, the other two, yeah. But when I went into these offender intervention groups, I was really blown away by the fact that any one of them would have been guys I'd have gone out for a beer with. Like, they were just normal guys. And so many of them did not want to be violent, but they had no other skill set. They had no other sort of vision of what they looked like in a moment of violence or how they were formed by the culture in which they lived. And one of the more fascinating scenes that I witnessed was in this jail in San Francisco, just outside of San Francisco, where they have a domestic violence wing and they have a year-long, five-day-a-week, six-hour-a-day anti-violence program, anti-domestic violence program. It's really quite fascinating. Of course, we don't replicate it because, you know, it costs money and we want to make money off things. But at any rate, was that cynical? That sounded a little cynical. Sorry. Not really sorry. One of the fascinating exercises I sat in on is something I'll just read two paragraphs of and then we'll open it up to questions. But it was called the separation cycle exercise, where one of the guys sits in the group and he describes a moment of violence. Maybe it was the inciting incident that got him in jail, or maybe it was some other moment of violence. But he deconstructs the moment. He talks about what his body did in the moment, how maybe his muscles clenched, maybe he hunched over. I can't really hunch because I threw out my back this morning, but I would be hunching normally. Or, you know, maybe he has adrenaline coursing through him, his voice raises, maybe there's drugs or alcohol involved. They talk about what his victim said or did to either collude or seemingly incite the violence that he wrought. They really spend an entire morning deconstructing this moment of violence. And then the guys in the group will point out to him the ways in which he's intimidating to look at, the ways in which his sense of manhood or expectation was threatened by this woman, and that's why he acted out in violence, or the ways in which our culture and our society sort of breed that response. And it's stunning to a lot of these guys to find out that they are formed by forces beyond just themselves, right? A lot of them are very narcissistic, and they're like, wait, what? Culture formed me? Society formed me? And it's really stunning to kind of watch that light bulb moment for a lot of them, especially because for a lot of the guys who are in jail, you know, if you're an abuser and you have money or you're white, you can almost always avoid jail time. So you're dealing with a very specific population, right, who could not avoid jail time. So I'm just going to read two paragraphs from one of these separation cycle exercises. This particular one took place not in the jail, but in the sheriff's office nearby. And it is led by a guy named Jimmy Espinoza, who is a former pimp and drug addict and abuser who went through this program in jail and is now one of the facilitators of it. And now he runs these programs in the same jail where he used to be an inmate. And he is training a guy named Dante Lewis, who has recently gone through the program and been released from jail and is attempting to be a facilitator. And I won't say what happens, but at some point in the writing of this book, I lose Dante for about 6 months. I can't find him, and then I do find him, but I don't want to tell you what happens. Dante is one of my favorite characters in this book. I say character, he's a real human being. Dante gathers dry erase markers and wet wipes. Participants wander in slowly, as if this is a kind of torture for them, which perhaps it is. "Who's the scribe tonight?" Dante asks. One man in sunglasses with teeth grills says it's him, writes on the whiteboard, separation cycle exercises. Denial, minimize, blame, collude. Some of the men arrive straight from work, others from wherever they've been hanging around all day. They nod to one another, crack a one-liner here or there. Someone whispers to the scribe, and he says, "Shit, man." Then he turns to me. "I apologize for my language, ma'am." Another one laughs and says, "Check it out, Fatal Peril Club right here." They understand fatal peril is the exact instant when a man's sense of expectation is most threatened. What the world owes him, what his own sense of self demands, something challenges him. Maybe his partner says something or does something and he reacts. Maybe a guy in a bar insults him. Maybe some coworker tells him he fucked up. It's a split second that changes everything. Eyes narrow, chests pump, fists clench, muscles tense, blood rushes. The body language is almost universal, running across race and class and culture, sometimes even species. A man, a lion, a bear. The body reacts the same way. Fatal peril. A moment that Jimmy and Dante hope to eventually show these men is a decision. Violence as a learned behavior. We don't know it, but we have another word for fatal peril. Snap. On the news, the mourning neighbor, the crying coworker, he just snapped. But the snap is a smokescreen, a cliche, a fiction. The snap doesn't exist. Thank you.
Hi, if you would raise your hand, we'll get a mic to you. Who would like to start us off? Well, I'll start us off. I'll follow up on the snap. Mm-hmm. If that doesn't exist, can you also talk about how some of our other perceptions about the stereotypical snap-related or history of domestic abuse, what we should be looking for, how a lot of that just is not correct?
So many things. I don't know. You know, I'm sure many of you have read Malcolm Gladwell, and Malcolm Gladwell has this whole body of work that I like to call like the contrarian philosophy. Like he's like, what is conventional wisdom? And then how can I turn it on its head? And I feel like that's what my learning about domestic violence was, this constant kind of like, oh, well, if restraining orders aren't renewed, then the problem is solved. Oh, well, if things were bad enough, she would just leave. Oh, well, I would recognize an abuser by the way he, I don't know, walks around the world as an angry guy. Or abusers just need anger management. That's what they need. All of those are wrong. And I go into kind of each one specifically, and I talk about why. But one of them is this issue of conflating anger management with batterer's intervention. You know, most batterers, and let me just say that only about a quarter of batterers fit that sort of like angry guy, right? That toxic sort of angry Donald Trump-like character. I'm sorry, I'm just going to say it, but you know, that guy's got abuse like written all over him. Unbelievable. Anyway, yeah, I'm going to get you out of here in time for the debates. Don't worry. So I would say we conflate anger management with batterer's intervention. And, you know, most batterers know how to comport themselves. They're not out there raging at everyone, their bosses, their coworkers, their family, whatever. It's about power and control over one person or one set of people. And so it's not at all about controlling your rage. It's about power, and it's about violence as a decision. I would say that's just one of just so many. I mean, the whole first third of the book is dedicated to the question of how wrong it is to ask, why doesn't she just leave? if I could like a year from now come back when the paperback comes out and people would be like, oh yeah, we never ask that question anymore. Instead, we ask, how can we protect her? Or why is he violent in the first place? Like those, let's ask those two questions.
Is law enforcement being trained to ask those questions? Is anybody being trained to ask those questions so that there can be early intervention that's effective?
That's a good question, and my answer is yes and no. I mean, in some places, it absolutely is. Like, D.C. is this incredibly progressive place, right, where you think, like, I mean, let's put federal politics aside, but, like, local politics, we voted 97% for Hillary Clinton. Like, we like, ran laps around San Francisco is all I'm saying in terms of our liberal politics, right? And yet, even there, when I'm doing ride-alongs with police, I notice they're not trained in strangulation, one of the top three signs of predictor of domestic violence homicide. Or, you know, the court system re-victimizes victims all the time. It's just, it's terrible. Or prosecutors say, well, she's not going to cooperate, not realizing that the context of her failure to cooperate is that she is trying to keep herself safe and her children safe. So I would say that yes, there are definite movements, and I cover a lot of them in the third part of the book, but like there's a lot more we could do, and the things that we could do are so small. I'll give you one example from Rocky and Michelle. When Michelle found out that, so Rocky only ever had the police called on him once, and it was Michelle's mother. He broke into Michelle's mother's house, kidnapped Christy because he and Michelle were in a fight, and took off for the night, right? A lot of abusers use the children as a bargaining chip. And so Michelle's mother called the police. Michelle went for the first time ever and filed a restraining order. And almost immediately after she filed a restraining order, his parents bailed him out. Not because they're evil, but because he was easily able to manipulate them in the same way that he had manipulated Michelle for years. He said, I promise I'll do better. A father has his right to his children. I know I did wrong. Please just like bail me out. I won't do anything. I promise, I promise, I promise. And they did. And by the time Michelle found out that Rocky had bailed out, he was already out. And she sped back to the DEA's office and recanted everything, including the fact that he had gone to the hills a month earlier, got a rattlesnake, and kept it in a cage in their home as a threat to put it in bed with her or in the shower. So she goes and recants. She says to the DA, no, no, I made up the snake thing. Well, of course the DA knows she's lying, but she's recanted. What do you do with a victim who recants? So they never press charges, and Michelle recants as an act of solidarity to keep Rocky on her side. Today, as a result of that, of the familicide of that family, anyone who's arrested in the state of Montana for domestic violence is not allowed to bail out until they see a judge, and they're not allowed to see a judge until after lunch. It's the tiniest little thing. And yet what it means is that a domestic violence advocate has just a few hours to get to a victim, to create a safety plan, to get an abuser on GPS, to change the locks, maybe to pack a bag and get her to shelter if that's what needs to happen. But sometimes it's a matter of just like a few hours to get to someone, to do a danger assessment to try to determine how much danger any kind of victim is in. And that doesn't cost a system anything, really. And that's just one of probably, I don't know, 50 or 100 examples that I have of communities doing different things like that in the country.
George Bernard Shaw said, if you want to see acts committed in the name of love, open the newspaper to the homicide column. Now, do these perpetrators experience themselves as being in love with and possessive of their wives and betrayed, and that justifies their behavior?
Yeah, that's a beautiful question. Thank you for that. I mean, love is what makes this different than any other crime, right? You don't have a bank robber who has love in his purview, right? Love is what I think enables law enforcement to be like, oh, it's a private matter, right? And until the 70s, most domestic violence literature in this country talked about it as if it was a woman inciting the violence because of her own actions. And if you listen to jailhouse calls, and I have listened to many, many, they follow a very similar script, and they almost always have some version of like, it's my love for you, bitch, that's making me do this. You know, it's like, oh my God, you're a moron. I mean, I can't help when I hear that. I just think, like, you know. But they all say that. Like, if I didn't love you so much, you know, you wouldn't make me act this way. It's my love for you. And so it is this very warped. And as, you know, speaking as a woman, I can tell you, you know, my dad said to me when I was 30 years old, which was a long time ago, he said, you know, your mother and I, we used to pray that you would find someone who would treat you well and make you happy, and now we'll just take anyone. We're funny, we Snyders. It was funny, but the subtext was like, my life was not complete somehow until I was partnered up, until I had, you know, a man in my life. And I think as women, we still get that narrative so much in the 21st century. I mean, you know, my daughter is 11, and I wouldn't let her watch Disney movies ever, because they all followed such a similar narrative that all the problems ceased once she had love, once she had a man. And it didn't matter if that man had kidnapped her from her own father for the taking of a rose, right? Like, that narrative of Sleeping Beauty, the Beast and the Beauty and the Beast, thank you. See, we don't watch Disney movies in my house. But that narrative is, you know, the reality and the texture of that narrative is left out of, I think, of our sort of national conversation. So yeah, I think it has everything to do. You know, I've been saying lately to people, like, imagine like your house gets broken into and a thief comes and takes all your stuff, and you call the police, and the police come and they say, my God, this is terrible. How terrible that you've been victimized by this thief. Well, you're going to have to leave your house now. The thief is going to go ahead and continue to live here. Like, that's what we essentially say to domestic violence victims when we put them in shelter, when we expect them to leave. I mean, our whole system needs to be revolutionized.
Can you speak at all about how this compares or contrasts to other, first world countries?
So I lived in Cambodia for 6 years. I lived in London before that. So Ireland, I've just in the last, I don't know, couple of weeks, Ireland seems to be doing some really innovative things. One of the things that they've done is create a hotline just for men. Ireland, France, and the UK all have coercive control laws against perpetrators now, which is something that is being considered in California and New York in the States, but nowhere else. And whether or not they pass in those states is questionable to me. So there is progress. You know, the big thing about America when it comes to domestic violence that is different from anywhere else in the world, whether it's developing or developed country, is guns. We have access to guns. And I gotta say, we gotta get rid of the guns. You know, I used to tiptoe around this issue. I used to be like, well, let me just understand the hunters. No, fuck that. I'm sorry. You know, we gotta get rid of the goddamn guns. So that's what makes it different. Yeah.
Is there a national data comparing cities? How long in this country have we been collecting data? And is the data showing a rise or a fall?
Do you mean data in terms of domestic violence, homicides, or
Not necessarily
guns,
just homicide. I mean, abuse.
What? Sorry.
Abuse. Violence.
Oh, abuse. Abuse. Okay. So there are bazillions of databases. So let me see if I can answer that a little bit. I will say that since 2017, domestic violence homicides in this country are up by 33%. 33%. Now, I don't know if anyone remembers what happened in 2017. Seems to me we had an election that was kind of an upheaval. Seems to me certain fringe elements are getting a lot of airtime. The Me Too movement really took steam. The Kavanaugh hearings happened. And I think, I mean, that those numbers just came out in the middle of May, about a week after my book was published, so they're not actually in the book, that increase in domestic violence homicides. But I think that we're going to look back on this moment and see, like, a direct correlation between the retaliatory violence and women sort of saying, you know what, we're sick of this. We are sick of it, and channeling rage. If you have not read Rebecca Traister's Good and Mad, I urge you to read it. There are also some studies, they're not databases, but they're studies looking at those jurisdictions that actually implement the federal ban on gun ownership for convicted abusers or stalkers. And they have found, unsurprisingly, corollaries between taking someone's guns when they are found guilty of abuse and a drop in homicide rates in those jurisdictions. California had a big study, for example, in one of them. And, you know, Omar Mateen, the Orlando Pulse shooter, I talk a little bit about the correlation between mass shootings and domestic violence homicides in my book, but you can even look at just domestic violence and mass shootings and look at Omar Mateen, who was a strangler, who was never convicted of strangling, which carries under federal law a 10-year sentence, and who then was able to get guns because he was never convicted. And what does he do? He goes off and kills 49 people. So there is strong evidence to suggest that guns increase homicide rates. And the third thing I'll say, and this is another reason why men need to be our allies, is that one of the ways that researchers determine if their domestic violence programs and policies in any jurisdiction are effective is that they look at the homicide rates of men. And when I first heard this, I was like, wait, what? You mean women? No, they meant men. Because what it said was that women don't have to kill their way out of an abusive situation with retaliatory violence. They actually have resources to get out of that abusive relationship, and thus there is a subsequent drop in homicides of men, which blew my mind, right? It's like Malcolm Gladwell again. And so, you know, there's a totally self-serving reason for men to join this fight with us, right? I don't know if that answers your question, but there are numerous databases on everything, but there's just a few.
The power difference between men and women has existed for eons and in just about all cultures. And abuse has occurred for eons in just about all cultures. And do you, when you think about this, do you have some thought about why we have evolved that way? I think about that quite a great
deal.
Yeah,
you know, I don't know if you've listened to the podcast Scene on Radio, S-C-E-N-E, but the second season is called Men, and it really looks at whether or not, one of the primary questions it asks is whether or not violence is inherent to men or whether it's a learned behavior. And one of the things that they found, and I had never thought about this, was that they didn't believe that men were inherently violent. Because men, even in the days of the Roman Empire or Alexander the Great, had to be cajoled into fighting through drink or some other mind-altering behavior. And you can look at that straight through to Vietnam and the use of drugs in Vietnam, or straight through to the LRA in Uganda, and see that like the reason that the kids are able to be trained as child soldiers is because they're high most of the time. And so, I do think that. There is a way in which we have been led to believe that men are inherently violent. But when I talked to those men in that prison in San Francisco, what I found was that because that program, which has been going on for 20 years, by the way, so it's got a long history, what I found was that there were huge waiting lists of men to get into that program because it had a reputation for nonviolence. So those men didn't want to be in violent situations any more than anyone else does. I do think that there is a different kind of toxic masculinity today that is being showcased by our leaders that is disturbing, like, to my core. And, you know, I think about, you probably all, you know, you're all book lovers. Awesome. But, you know, about 3 weeks ago, there was a disturbance at Politics and Prose bookstore by like 10 alt-right guys, I think one woman and mostly guys, who came in, and it was an author who wrote the book White Fragility, and these 10 people came in and disrupted and said, you know, white power, white whatever, and they had a bullhorn. And Politics and Prose is like my local bookstore. Like, my daughter and I go there to do her homework. Like, it's a place we hang out. And so it was really disturbing, and it made national news. I don't know if you remember this. And by, I don't know, midnight that night, I was following it on Twitter, and by midnight that night, they had identified 5 of the 10, and they came from sort of all over the Eastern Seaboard. They came from Pennsylvania, West Virginia, North Carolina, I think was one, and it just struck me, like, their numbers are so small. that they had to pull from all these different states just to get 10 people in a city of 750,000. We're winning! Like, we're winning! Like, I really was. I mean, maybe my cup is half full, but I was like, yes, yes. Like, they got a lot of airtime, but there's 10 of them, there's 750,000 of us. Like, you know, so I just think as maybe it sounds warped, but it does give me hope. It gives me hope.
Hi. So I'm 30 years old, and it's been a minute since I was in school. But I think there is an obvious need, if there isn't already, for a major push for public education around this. So I was hoping maybe you're somewhat informed about what's going on the public education front. And I think it's very easy to educate people while they're in school, but maybe once they leave school, it's harder to reach people. What's your sense about this dynamic?
You know, that's a really good question, because one of the things that researchers found is that domestic violence victims don't often just go straight to law enforcement. Instead, they go to their clergy or they go to healthcare workers, they go to their doctors. So in some ways, our education, at least for adults, needs to be in those categories as well. I know that the research says that we need to be starting with middle school. Michelle Monson Mosier was 14 when she met Rocky, and that is not at all unusual for someone to meet, you know, when they're very young. There are a number of programs that are starting now, but even, again, in D.C., like, my kid goes to a public school, and she came back, I don't know, about 2 months ago with her hair braided, and she had not left the house that way, and I thought, oh, how'd that happen? And she said, oh, it was Girls Empowerment Day. And I was like, well, okay, but the hairstyle. She's like, no, well, we braided each other's hair. And I was like, oh, that was your empowerment, was braiding each other's hair? And I was like, okay, that leaves out any girl who is not of that normative type, first of all. And that's like, nah. But here was the second thing that she said that was so disturbing. I said, well, what did the boys do? She said, oh, they didn't even know. And I was like, you know, there I am writing to the principal. Hello, I love how much you educate my kid. It's so great, but what the hell? Like, come on. So I do think that we absolutely need to have education like that. I know that Michelle Obama's foundation has a huge push for educating middle school people. In fact, I'm talking to them right now about whether or not they can partner with some of the other programs that are working. New York has a very good one, actually, for middle school. But they're very ad hoc, and they are based in sort of areas where heteronormative relationships aren't necessarily the only ones that exist, right? So this is part of the problem, is just that we are becoming so, so divisive. But like 11, 12, like my kid's age, that's the age that we need to start.
Hi, thank you so much for being here and having this forum today. I'm on the board of directors of a domestic violence program. I'm here with another one of my colleagues and board directors.
Thank you.
Yes, and we actually, our agency has been around for almost 40 years now, and next year will be 40 years, and we do quite a bit of the things that you have mentioned thus far. So we've had a very active, I've been on the board for 16 years, so probably even longer than that, advocacy programs, healthy dating programs in the schools. We actually started out with a program in elementary school called Hands Are Not for Hitting. And worked with programs there, and as we do. So our agency is Laurel House, and we're located in Montgomery County, which is a suburb of Philadelphia. And we have a shelter, so we're a totally comprehensive program that, and I'm doing a publicity for us, but I'm basically saying that you talked about ad hoc programs that are doing this type of work here and there, and yes, and the struggle, you know, so much of the time is funding.
Let me just say one thing about that, because you're absolutely right that the funding is not valued, and the Violence Against Women Act has to be reauthorized every 5 years. The 2013 Act was really the first time that it did not have much bipartisan support. The GOP did not like the protections that were put in for Native American women and LGBTQ women, And the Democrats did manage to get some of those funding protections in, but in the 2018 Violence Against Women Act still has not been passed. It is an abomination. It is an abomination. And as I say in my book, it is already so underfunded that Jeff Bezos could fund it for 300 years and still have millions to live on. I did the math myself. I don't want to brag, but I did. David Corey, friend from grad school. Yes.
I've never met you something. In my life.
Yeah.
So I actually want to circle back to the question about school kids and like when is the correct time to, you know, catch them and really begin to teach them nonviolence and so on. And as this gentleman was questioning and you were responding, I was thinking about how one of the bright spots in this country and right now, at least, when it comes to that age group and learning how to sort of engage with each other in nonviolent ways are the prevalence of restorative justice programs that are popping up all over the country in school settings. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Character education is now really sort of becoming a growing theme, mm-hmm. Not just in, you know, your more affluent communities, but in fact, more so in the less affluent communities where things like restorative justice really does have teeth. Mm-hmm. So I know just from my own understanding of that whole world that restorative justice, as an example, actually in this country really kind of found its first footing in prison settings and, you know, those real heavy, you know, mm-hmm. Capital F forgiveness type situations. Did you come across any of that type of stuff as you were visiting prisons, or was it?
Yeah, so restorative justice is really an attempt to restore some sense of, justice, I guess, to victims of crime. And so in San Francisco, for example, in the jail I went in, they every Wednesday have a victim of domestic violence come in and speak about his or her experience with violence. And for many of the guys there, it's the first time that they have ever listened to what their violence does to somebody. I would say, and I'll you know, sort of leave you with this thought, that I don't think any discussion of domestic violence can really happen in this country without a corollary discussion of prison reform. And I recognize that. I don't agree with the idea that we are putting too many people behind bars for domestic violence specifically. I think there are many people behind bars for minor crimes, but I think that, and shouldn't be, but I think that there is a movement afoot that is a little disturbing to me these days of, for example, taking domestic violence advocates out of prison, police stations. Wow, that was a Freudian slip. Out of police stations because they don't want to, that we don't want to, you know, jail our way out of this situation. And I think that impetus for a domestic violence victim is pretty profound and needs to be really carefully kind of disentangled because love is part of it, because a relationship is part of this criminal behavior, and because it happens usually over a very long period of time, years and years. It's not like one crime, one time, right? And so it's a very different scenario. But yes, I do think restorative justice is one of the important bedrocks of any kind of offender intervention program. So,
please join me in thanking Rachel Louise Snyder.
So I'll sign books, right? Yeah.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.